Welcome to the Healing Ground Movement, a podcast dedicated to revolutionizing how we think about our bodies and our health. I'm your host, Dr. Carly Hudson, DC, and I have lived my life in pursuit of holistic healing and care that goes beyond symptom management. If you've been listening and like what you're hearing, head over to your favorite platform and leave us a review so we can reach more people with our important message. Enjoy today's episode. Ending season one on an upbeat note, we're going to listen to some empowering and enlightening words of wisdom from our previous guests. I know that there are a lot of problems and we shine a lot of light on them at the Healing Ground Movement, but there is more good than bad, and let's focus on that too. Taking this out into the community and helping others know what it is to thrive in different situations. Where are you going with that?
Right now I do that through speaking and doing workshops and also through my writing. I feel that a lot of people limit themselves. And I know I do that to myself too. I set limits for myself in different areas of my life and have trouble getting over those barriers. But at the same time, as an athlete, like I know that a barrier is just, you know, it's just a kind of a temporary thing in your way, and you have to think your way over it or around it or whatever. And so I you know, my message is just teaching people that yes, there are barriers in all of our lives, and you know, it's a matter of how you think and how you kind of operate to be able to get around those barriers. And I want to share my experiences with sport and with my injury and, you know, how to get around those, you know, when it comes to other areas of your life. Maybe, you know, your blocks are in business or in relationships or, you know, whatever the case may be. I always believe there's a way around it. It's just, you know, sometimes it takes longer. Sometimes it takes, you know, learning different lessons, you know, things like that. I mean, I have plenty of lessons to learn, but I'm also really eager to learn, you know, like I want to know how to problem solve when I get up against one of those obstacles.
Well, I think there is a real opportunity to talk about mindset and appreciate that there, like you said, that there are barriers everywhere. And there's a lot of times that I've been told through my injuries, through head injury and being hearing impaired and all of these different pieces that I've had, that that is the most insurmountable thing. And to me, the truth is, when you learn to live with something, you learn to live with something. And it doesn't have to remain insurmountable. And we can know that there are other places in your life. So when you bring up businesses, or for some people with relationship or finances, these are just very physical, easy to point at things. But this idea of having a growth mindset and an insatiable thirst to just do more applies everywhere.
Right. And just, you know, just knowing that, you know, you might not know how to do something yet, but the information is out there. Information for anything is out there. It's just having that desire. And I think that's where people get caught and they don't understand, is that, you know, when I talk and I, you know, do my motivational speeches and I talk about doing Ironman, and people come up to me afterwards and, you know, say, wow, I could never do an Ironman. I can't believe you do that. And, you know, my question back to them is, well, do you want to? Because that's the thing. If you don't want to, of course you're never going to be able to, because you're not going to have the passion to take the time to go to do a 10-hour bike ride or to travel across the country or across the world to go do one of these competitions. And so, you know, like, do I have the motivation to become a multimillionaire? Probably not. You know, like, sure, I'd love to make a lot of money and I want to work hard and get there. But do I want to put my whole life into, you know, doing that? No, because there's other things that I want to do. And so that's where you just have to decide what's your priority, what's your passion, and then go do that and do that to the best of your abilities. And, you know, the other things, obviously, you have to do some sort of maintaining or learning or whatever along the line. But you don't have to, you know, it doesn't, there's not one right way to live. And that's what is so, you know, I think difficult for people for some reason to understand.
I think so, that there's this idea of what should be done. And we should be doing Ironman, you know, being able to do Ironmans. And we should have
you know, huge financial freedom, and we should. But the fact of the matter is, if you needed to set up emailing lists and pipelines for your billion-dollar industry, you wouldn't have time for your 10-hour ride.
Right, exactly.
And where your joy comes from is that 10-hour ride.
Exactly.
Versus someone who likes connecting with people through email and having that kind of funneling and figuring out those systems. Then it becomes not work, but something that fills you up.
Right. And to your point, too, is that you don't have to want to be an Olympian mm-hmm. or a Paralympian or an Ironman. You might want to do a sprint triathlon every 5 years, you know, and that's fine, too. Like, it's just, it's all about being true to who you are and mm-hmm. what you want. And so many people are so concerned about what it looks like on the outside that they can't be true to themselves. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is really unfortunate. And something that I want to share with people is that it's not that I became an Ironman or that I became a Paralympian. Mm-hmm. It's that I followed what I wanted to do, and I followed what makes me me.
Yeah. You know? I think that's the big takeaway. There's nothing very glamorous about that. There's no shiny trophy for that.
No.
But it is what gets you the shiny trophy.
It is, but it's still not a glamorous life or anything.
No. it's that uncomfortable, I don't have any other choice but to do what I am doing.
Yeah.
For my own joy and my own happiness, when it comes to this really dramatized idea of how did you make yourself do it? How did you push yourself through the pain and the relearning and the what have you? It's, I don't really have any other choice to be happy.
Right,
you know?
Exactly. It's just what I wanted to do. And mm-hmm. that's, you know, it's how you get to what you want.
Yeah.
But you have to clear out the things that you don't want mm-hmm. or the things that don't serve you or interest you or, you know, that kind of thing. So
what do you think are sort of more attainable ways for people to start tapping into that? Is there something that you share when you do your talks as far as?
I think, you know, a lot of it is really sitting with yourself and mm-hmm. listening to yourself and just finding out, A, what drives you, what motivates you, and mm-hmm. then B, tuning out the noise of what you think you should be on the outside. Mm. And I do that a lot through writing. I'll do that through my journal. And, you know, this is what I want. This is what I'm after. And if I look through my journal, it's amazing, actually.
Yeah.
Like, the themes are completely the same. Even the words that I use, like, I'll look at something 5 years ago and at something today and be mm-hmm. like, oh my gosh, I use that exact phrase. So it's mm-hmm. like, I know that is what's running through my head because it was running through it 5 years ago and still running through it today. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, that's kind of how I find, you know, what are the recurring themes? What is it that I really want? Mm-hmm. Because sometimes you get with your friends and, you know, like my best friend, for instance, has 4 kids. And she is an amazing mother. Her kids are awesome. And I love their family unit. Mm-hmm. Is that for me? No. And so, but when I look at her, I'm like, oh, I want 4 kids. I want my life to look like that. Mm-hmm. But it wouldn't be my life then because that's not what feeds me. And so, you know, it's so easy to look at what somebody else has mm-hmm. and say, oh, that's awesome. But it's only awesome because it looks good on them.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, you wearing your jeans and then me wearing your jeans. Like, they look awesome on you. Put them on me, they're not going to look so good. You know what I mean?
It's just not built the same.
No. So you got to find the jeans that fit and wear them and be okay with that. And mm-hmm. just say, you know what? My jeans are a size 12 and yours are a size 8 or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And just be okay with that.
Well, and I think when we look at other people and you look at your friend with the family of 4 or someone looks at you competing in the Paralympics or doing the Ironman, what we are envious of or wish that we had, you know, wish I could do was have the joy that you're experiencing right now.
Exactly.
That I want to feel as good as you feel completing your Ironman. Not actually completing an Ironman because I would feel like total crap.
Right.
That would not be for me. But the joy that you're doing.
And that's very well said. It is about seeing the joy that somebody else has mm-hmm. and wanting that. But that's still, you know, it's still misleading because you can mm-hmm. see the joy when I come back from the Ironman.
Yeah.
But you did not see what it looked like the morning when I woke up and I was like, oh, I don't want to be exercising for 16 hours today. Right. Or, you know, the day I came home from work and I had to ride 6 hours and I was exhausted. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, the day that I had to ride when it was 25 degrees out and I was frozen. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? So it's like, It's the Facebook thing, you know? It's like that's only a snapshot in time, mm-hmm. and you have to think that there's other things about it, you know?
In the midst of global chaos this summer, Janet Alves and I sat down to discuss valuing this one precious life you have and just what you want to do with it.
How could an entire beautiful system of movement possibly be only based in the realm of self-defense? Self-defense for me is on the outer realm. At the core is learning day by day, what is this beautiful life? And how does this beautiful life relate to other life, all kinds of life? So I found these women by the name of Noro. And there are some other things written about them now, so that there is more information, which I'm very happy about. So the Noro would be the kind of the center of the community and help to make these connections from ourselves as human beings to the spirit world, animal world, plant world, the ground. So all of this, as we have come from the ground, mm-hmm. all of these movements also come from the ground. So knowing about the roots and honoring the exchange in a respectful way, because it's also possible to steal. Mm-hmm. And stealing anything has to do with making a disconnection. Mm-hmm. And therefore you take energy out of whatever that is. You destroy energy. As far as I'm concerned, the cycles that are portrayed in these arts have everything to do with the natural creation destruction cycles. Mm-hmm. And they are natural, right? Because as you point out, we're gonna die. But where does our energy go? Okay, we have human stories about that, but nobody can prove where we came from or where we're going, right? We can have a big feeling about it. So that big feeling, when somebody chooses to make a disconnection by stealing or in whatever way, to me, that dishonors the creation destruction. That word destruction, maybe it's just, you know, maybe we don't understand in English what this cycle means, because nothing is ever actually destroyed, disappeared in terms of energy, apparently, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
But when I'm causing suffering, suffering happens. But mm-hmm. when I'm promoting suffering, mm-hmm. that is unnecessary and is not skillful.
I love the language choice of promoting suffering and this idea of the cycle of creation destruction. It's so important right now, particularly as our world, our global world, has hit this, you know, literal boiling point. And yeah. You know, here in Colorado for the last few weeks, and California as well, we have been on fire. We have had a massive destruction on fire. I think there were 5 burning this last weekend, and of course we got a ton of snow from that, but we got the snow from the heat rising and the fire destroying the old burnout, because, you know, we also have a lot of beetle kill. We have a lot of old dying trees, and that destructive fire becomes part of the natural process, the natural turnover of a forest that needs a chance to renew, because from those ashes we will get the new greenery, we'll get the new foliage. Now, of course, that's going to be different than someone carelessly leaving a cigarette and causing a burn in a forest that isn't ready to turn, that is new and fresh. You can still burn down a forest that it's not its time. And you can still take a life, you can still steal a life that it's not its time.
That's right.
And it's a very tenuous difference. But to go back to your point of valuing life, valuing passion, I would imagine that as you value your own life and the passion of this one flame that you are carrying with you, you know, you start to value others as well and can respect they will have their time to leave. And it is not of your power to make them suffer and leave faster. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. And mm-hmm. human beings creating this imbalance. Mm-hmm. through so much disconnection, disconnection from ourselves, disconnection from where we receive resources, how we receive resources. The whole earth is a gift. And so apparently, as human beings, since we are part of the earth, we are a gift, and we have gifts to give back. And so, for instance, to have this this gesture, which I consider a universal human gesture, everywhere I've ever been,
of palms together, people know, listening.
Yeah, exactly. People know something about this. Everybody has done it. Everybody has a feeling. It's not religious. It's not anything in particular, except for what you make from the feeling. So the feeling, I ask people, put your palms together, let your shoulders drop, you know, just feel like, what does that feel like? And generally comments are in the range of peaceful, calm, connected, loving, open-hearted, et cetera, et cetera. But this is also a protective gesture. So if somebody were to enter my space, let's say grab my hands, and they were not welcome, they were meaning harm, it's not that difficult to go up around and make this kind of spiraling motion, which we do all the time as part of our moving meditation. It's a basic gesture, and it's actually pretty easy to remove somebody's hands to open their grip. So this is one example of how all of these life-giving forces that we express through movement are actually also very protective. From the beginning, because they help increase our sense of calm, and calmness is protective because it is good for the immune system.
Yes.
all the way to that moment of fear when we might be freezing because we're so scared that we, you know, we follow that constricted breathing, which is the definition of fear, right? We go like this. That freezing moment I just described to people, and then they feel it. That freezing moment is a concentration of energy. And then from there, right, you burst open. Like a seed pod that's just ready to go into the world. And that helps release you from that constriction of fear. And it's also a physical release if somebody is trying to grab you. So it goes on and on in terms of the spiraling cycle of promoting life, promoting healing, promoting, you probably know the word holos. Comes from, it's a Greek word, and it means holistic, so it means integrity. So healing is about promoting integrity, and people think, oh, you know, I'm going to go to the doctor, I'm going to get my fix, and I'll be all better. Healing is a lifelong process of basically finding balance, noticing the imbalance, seeking out help from inside, from outside, and finding that next level of integrity, which is connection, which is relationship of all kinds. And then you just come back around to, oh, now I feel more connected. Wow, now I feel more energy. Oh, now I know my actual power rather than something that is assigned to me because of the color of my skin or my gender, or, you know, those kind of the false sense that we get from cultural boxes. And then all that produces is insecurity, which comes out often as arrogance. And how do you connect with that? You know, because it's meant to disconnect us, those boxes. So it just,
Yeah, it creates that hierarchy, and it puts one in a place where we can't be touched because of a higher level of belonging, and I use generous air quotes here, or a lower level of belonging. And in reality, there is this global connection, and we have created systems with blocks and deterrents to continue this idea that anyone is better than another. We have baked it into our culture versus understanding that there is a cycle and a give and take for everybody. Yeah. And I can't believe I didn't know the Greek origin of healing after all this time, because we do talk about salutogenic healing a lot in my office and here on the podcast, which is different than the very commonly understood, though maybe not labeled, pathogenic healing, where if there's something wrong within us, something less ideal, and I'll try not to use negative terminology, but just something that isn't working within us, the idea is to, yes, go get it cut out, take a drug to poison it, or take a drug to regulate it, versus having an idea that maybe it is a sign of somewhere in that cycle, we have hit a place of dis-ease. We have hit a place of working less, but it's not necessarily a bad thing, because just like that analogy you did of that fear pulling in to burst forward, we have this sign of overdoing, undernourishing, maladaption to teach us what we could do better to be a healthier expression of ourself. And the idea that that healthier expression of ourself needs to be the end all be all, well, you still have many more years to go. I certainly hope it's not. You will have another cycle of maladaption and growth to come from that, should you choose, or continue disconnect to cut out and poison. Now, that's not saying there isn't emergency medicine that we need intervention. It saved my life. It's why I'm here. But the day to day, could we look at a more holistic approach?
We began 18 months ago with our very first episode featuring Cheryl Ilove. She discusses how the challenge becomes the gift, and with empowerment, the work is yours.
So I know that you're currently growing a community of support for people to find their voice and stand their ground, finding mm-hmm. that deeper center. Mm-hmm. How did you get there from the beginnings as a PT? How did you flow there?
Ooh, my goodness. That's really an interesting question. Oh, how did that work? I was so deeply involved mm-hmm. in the lifelong learning yes. process, like you are as well. And along the way, along with the ballet and the martial arts and Pilates, I discovered something called Feldenkrais. Mm-hmm.
And give a little synopsis of what it is.
Feldenkrais is a highly sophisticated form of neuromuscular reeducation based on the scientific principle of neuroplasticity.
Wonderful.
Which simply means, as you know, yes. that we are capable, our nervous system is capable of learning new things and changing during the entire course of our lifetime. However, when I was in physical therapy school, and it wasn't really that long ago, I graduated in 96, we mm-hmm. were taught that this miracle of nature, this neuroplasticity, only existed in the human body, the human brain, until the age of 14, and then it just disappeared.
And I think when I got my doctorate, we were up to 27. And that was only
That's great.
5 years ago.
Isn't that incredible?
Which, I mean, of course, we know since then there's a lot of research coming out right. that says it never leaves.
We always
have the chance to change our brain and change the way our bodies work.
Yeah.
But it's this whole arena is such a fast-changing place of study. So I love that back in the 90s, which to me will always be last year, but I guess it's really like 20 years ago, you were getting into this idea of neuroplasticity.
I loved the idea. And mm-hmm. the funny thing is, Feldenkrais, it's kind of a funny name, but yes. it's actually based on the guy who developed the system and the method, which was Moshe Feldenkrais. And he was born in, I believe it was 1900, and then he died in 1983. Okay. So he was way ahead of his time.
Oh, absolutely.
And he developed the method from a terrible knee injury that he had. He experienced a really bad injury from playing soccer. He was an athlete. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he kind of rehabbed it, and then he would notice that just stepping off the curb, his knee would, turn or do something
Buckle.
Funny. Yeah, and the whole thing would start all over again. So for years, he really struggled with this knee problem and the knee pain and stiffness, and to the point where it was really impacting his ability to move and his mobility. So he went to so many therapists. You know, this is back in probably the 1930s when this was going on. Maybe the 40s, I don't know. But he was finally faced with surgery, and he was told that the only thing they could do would be knee surgery. Now, think about knee surgery back then.
think about knee surgery now.
I don't even want to.
Yeah.
But back then.
100 years ago.
Oh, yes. Gee, what a nightmare. And he asked the surgeon, well, you know, what's the success rate? And he says, maybe 50-50 if you're lucky. And he's like, thank you very much. And he left. So figured, I know. So, and this is what I love about him. And a lot of the different movement arts that I've studied along the way, through this adversity came triumph and came his own path. So he discovered a way to pay attention to how he moved, like foot placement, hip placement. So through this incredibly slow and tedious process of self-awareness, he was able to heal his own knee.
It's phenomenal. So often the challenge becomes the gift. It gives you the opportunity to slow down that you would never take in your everyday life.
Right.
And turn your awareness inward. And I love that he created such, I mean, and anyone who hasn't engaged with Feldenkrais before, it's a phenomenal neuromuscular retraining.
But I'm glad you said that, because it does take time.
It does. It's not overnight.
It's not overnight, but yet when it happens, it's yours and you really own it. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference between saying, give me this pill, you know, go ahead and do this surgery. And a lot of times if you have surgery, sometimes you end up having another surgery and then another. So to have that kind of, to me, that's truly empowerment and personal empowerment, is being able to understand your own body and the sensations going through it and how to be able to heal it yourself.
Phenomenal.
Yeah. Wow. And to get help along the way from people who can just give you a boost like you do.
But it becomes so much of the work is yours. The information and the resourcing comes from those that you find in your community. Right. But the work is yours.
And the responsibility is basically.
Even more important, the responsibility.
Yes.
So tell us about this project. Who are you speaking to? What is this voice that you are cultivating?
I am trying to cultivate everybody finding their own true voice and their own true message, finding their own path, to be able to stand their ground, find their voice, and again, discover your own true self. That sounds a little corny, and that's something that comes from Feldenkrais, your own true self. And when I was going through the Feldenkrais training, which is a 4-year-long program, I swore, I says, I will never say some of these phrases that all the Feldenkrais people say. And it was like, oh no, I'm saying it now.
But it turns out he was right.
Exactly. Yes. Once again, there's that stubbornness coming through. But when you know yourself and you can find your own true path, Moshe also used to call it living your avowed dream.
Say that one more time, your avowed dream?
Your avowed dream.
Wow.
Because everybody has their own true path. Absolutely. And what makes them whole and completely human. And again, as we said, we're all different.
Yes.
And if you're walking a path that really doesn't belong to you, then you're not fulfilled. You're not happy. You're not healthy.
Yes.
So if you can get back on track, and I really believe that a lot of things that happened to me along the way with my back pain and a couple of the other things, as you know, that, you know, I was assaulted when I was in my 40s, and that's how I ended up in martial arts. But I really believe that all those things that happened set me up for my own true path so that I can be a mouthpiece and I can share this to other people. And it's like, if I could do it, anybody could do it.
And I love that sense. And you're really just walking the path that we described with Feldenkrais earlier, is that you are owning your journey and you're owning your truth.
Yeah.
And when you have that kind of self-possessed nature, not only do you get the benefits of that struggle, but you have the wisdom to share.
And I want to share the message of hope to other people, who, because everybody's got their history.
Yes.
Life is full of hits, and we do not get up through this little game of life without our own fair share.
Yes.
And what you do with those hits and how you recover from them and the flexibility, which is another thing that I got from martial arts and Feldenkrais, because Feldenkrais was a judo expert. So he was the first non-Asian, the first European to earn a black belt in judo.
Fantastic.
And from the guy who created the,
the whole thing.
Judo thing.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
But I like, just to kind of draw you back, that what you said is that we all take our hits and we all have our moments. And you were sort of, I don't know, the sentiment of anyone can do it and everyone is going to have their journey. It's not this hero's journey of look at me, how much I got knocked down.
Right.
It's we're all toiling in this together.
Right.
And let's find the resources that we need.
That's another thing what I'm doing with this community is to try and tie people into those resources.
Yeah.
And to create that cross-reference, like I called it my Femininja All-Stars, yes, which you are it. One of my All-Stars.
That's one of my favorite clubs to be part of. it's such a fun group, and what brilliant ladies. I finally get to meet one of them next week. Well, aside from Ashley.
Right. But yeah, and you are so brilliant, each one of you. And each one of you have had your own struggles and have been able to recover from that and come onto the other side. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that there's not going to be another hit in the future? Absolutely not. But you've got enough resources now to handle them. So this is the message that I want to share to people who might be feeling hopeless, who might be feeling at their wit's end, to never give up. There's always a way. There is always a way to recover from whatever it is that you're struggling with, whether it's physical, mental, emotional, psychological, financial, relationships, you name it. There is always another way. So you're never at a dead end.
I love it. And I think that's a message that is so pertinent and so necessary these days. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are struggling with mental, emotional, and physical dead ends and just not being sure where to turn. And so much of the answer is to find resources and turn inward.
And to be able to move through it.
Yes. Don't stop.
Don't stop. Keep moving.
Journey had it right.
Exactly.
Don't stop believing.
Don't stop. But any kind of physical movement is going to help you mentally and cognitively work through problems. Like anytime that you really feel stuck, because you know, I'm preaching to the choir.
Yes.
But for the listeners, anytime that you do feel stuck, just stop what you're doing. Go outside, take a walk around the block. You know, do a little jig in your kitchen, sit on a ball, bounce around a little bit, do something. And all of a sudden, you're going to work through a lot of those blocks. Some of the best solutions I ever came up with to problems that I was having was when I was practicing my kihon in my own living room.
And moving through it.
Exactly.
Well, and so much of the resources today are saying, what if I could tell you something that would improve your overall health, make you live longer, make you think better, make you a happier person, and you only had to do it 3 times a week? And of course, the answer is exercise. Mm-hmm. And of course, the real answer is move.
Yeah.
And it's just a resource that is at our fingertips and we don't know how to change.
Finally, Dr. Reed Pierce joined us to discuss positivity practices and its impact on a salutogenic approach to health.
So a couple of interesting things have come forward. One is this really powerful idea of pathogenesis and salutogenesis. So that's grounded in, you know, clinical practice for many of us, but I think it took probably 5 years of me being in this space before I heard the conversation start to turn towards this idea that, hey, if we're focused on burnout, which is sort of a pathogenic idea, and we focus solely on getting that to zero, meaning let's remove the bad stuff.
Yeah.
So in clinical medicine, cut it out, right? Get rid of it.
Poison it.
Does that actually get us to thriving and to the sort of holistic, humanistic world that we want? The answer is no.
Yeah.
So there's this parallel set of things we need to be working on that I'll call salutogenic. So how do we grow the good stuff?
And can I interrupt you for a second? Because we've talked about pathogenic and salutogenic before on the podcast. It's a concept that I am like married to now. But could you give us the technical difference between the two as you see it applying to what you're doing?
Yeah. So maybe I'll give a clinical example and then in well-being. So pathogenesis would focus on, you know, what's broken with you, what can we fix? So if, you know, if you have high cholesterol, then my goal is to get your cholesterol number down. I'm going to give you a medicine to reduce that. And if we get the cholesterol level below a certain level, then we're good because we've reduced the risk. The number looks okay to me. Now, there's a whole parallel set of conversations about, well, how is your diet? How is your exercise? Are you living in a well way as a human being that we didn't even address? Because I just looked at a number, I gave you a medicine, and I got that number below a certain threshold. So salutogenic might look at that same phenomenon and say, what would a sort of holistic and healthy approach be to eating well, to exercising often, to sleeping better? All those things actually impact how your body processes fat and cholesterol. And can we get you doing more of those things that are good not only for your cholesterol, but for you as a human being, for your sleep, for your mood, for your physical stamina, et cetera? So if you take that idea and you move it over to well-being, we can look at healthcare and we can say, gosh, one of the major pain points that seems to have arisen is the fact that our introduction of digital technology and electronic health record, which on balance is a good thing because mm-hmm. now nobody has to read my handwriting, which is great, and we can send messages back and forth, whereas used to you would have to print out your copies of your medical record and take them elsewhere.
I still do. I'm still on paper charts. Don't tell anybody.
Yeah. So that's part of the journey, the promise, yeah. right? What that thing has done is it has introduced this phenomenon where the human beings trying to have a conversation about health and well-being mm-hmm. now are distracted by the need to type a bunch of stuff into a computer.
Yeah.
There's sort of this third person, this digital partner in the room, and that feels like it takes away. So what we need to do... Mm-hmm. pathogenic is to reduce the disruption of the electronic medical record so that we can connect again as human beings, and that's good for me and it's good for you and we do our work better, etc. Well, that's fine, but what about salutogenic things that we can do that are good for well-being beyond just reducing the hassle of the electronic medical record? Like, does having a gratitude practice in our clinical team or in the clinician-patient relationship impact us in a way that actually is good for us as humans? Well, it turns out there's science that says it does. It affects a whole host of measures. If we're looking for stuff that's going well in our daily work and we're calling that out and we're celebrating that as individuals mm-hmm. and as teams. So working on the EHR will never get you to a gratitude practice directly. So this sort of dual system of saying, where are the things we can reduce that will improve well-being in the care delivery system? And what are the things that we need to grow because they're salutogenic? A lot of the stuff that is coming out right now in the grow category is around a lot of the positive psychology movement that has been out in the literature for now 20 or 30 years.
That's fantastic. And I like that looking at that in that pathogenic versus salutogenic is that salutogenic offering or solution rarely looks like the thing that you're trying to reduce. So it's a little bit of a long walk for a short drink of water to see how it would work. But if you have, say, that gratitude practice and that looking at that positivity, then there's less of a frustration of, I just need to get this done. Can you, and that just felt like a parenting moment for me too. It's like, I'm grateful about everything. So now I have the patience to take that moment, which really doesn't lengthen the visit or the interaction that long, but it's that pause for eye contact. Mm-hmm. It's that pause for listening and understanding that wasn't really the EHR's fault that it was gone, but it became a very easy tool to use in its place. Mm-hmm. Versus that gratitude practice or that positivity, now I have that breath, that lack of burnout to turn to you human to human.
Right.
Because that's what we want to get back is the human connection.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all of those sorts of things. The other thing that I think is very interesting is if you look at stress, forms of stress in medicine and healthcare and healing, we have these moments where stress occurs. So part of it may be that someone comes to see you or me mm-hmm. Feeling very stressed about his or her situation. And that stress gets transferred, right, as we start to have that conversation.
Absolutely.
Or it could be the other way around. I need to share some information about what I'm finding in the course of, the clinical diagnostic workup, or you said something and you thought it was this condition, but actually now I'm worried about something else and I'm breaking a form of bad news, which is stressful because you weren't thinking about or worrying about that thing, but I need to tell you, hey, we maybe need to focus on this.
Yeah.
So stress comes up all the time in our work, and if you take these positive practices, so gratitude being one of them, and there are a whole host of them we can talk through in a moment. If you have those embedded, what happens to us at a human level is when I feel stress, my recovery from that stress actually goes faster and better. So my heart rate comes down sooner, my stress hormones come down sooner, my ability to come back into a stance where mm-hmm. I can be open and try to connect as a human as opposed to be in that headspace of I'm stressed, I'm worried, I need to protect myself, I need to sort of back up from whatever's going on. That window closes faster mm-hmm. and it allows us to get back into this humanity piece sooner. So there's something real to this. It's not just we're trying to make people feel good.
Yeah.
There's actually a clinical effect to these salutogenic practices around well-being.
Well, I remember learning about a concept that it's not about like how much stress, what big events of stress are coming into your life. It's about the micro doses mm-hmm. of stress and having that threshold. And you can think of it as any kind of hairpin trigger, that if you have had micro doses of stress all morning, all day, and you haven't done anything to drop that back down, then the next micro dose, whatever it is, and as a clinician, unfortunately, you have to give bad news with some sort of frequency. This should be old hat. It's still stressful. So even though it's a microdose, it pushes above that limit. Mm-hmm. And then you can keep pushing higher and higher and higher. And without the reset, all those little things do start to add up. And then it shows up, like you're saying, in the physiology of heart rate and cortisol. And when the stress hormones are constantly high, it affects our cholesterol. It's all downstream effects mm-hmm. just from not taking a moment to find that those positivity practices.
Right.
Not just, but for an example.
Right. And this idea, and this is one of the other, I think, helpful shifts around how do we tackle this thing, this mm-hmm. big complex web. Early on, I think when people were talking about burnout as a thing in healthcare, as an example, mm-hmm. A lot of the early conversation, if you go back and you read what people were writing, were about these very important and also incredibly difficult to tackle, I think of them as structural issues. So mm-hmm. The payment model in medicine is not aligned with our core values and how we want to take care of people. It means that visits are shorter than they should be. And until we solve that, I can't feel good about the work I do. My patients can't feel good about seeing me if I'm in the clinic. Or the electronic health record we talked about. That thing, until somebody fixes it, I'm just sort of a victim of the system. And what that mindset, I think, leads to is this hope that there's going to be like one, two, maybe three big things that suddenly change, and then we can all be well again in our work. Instead, it's what you just mentioned, Carly, which is small doses frequently. Like, that's mm-hmm. the rhythm we have to get into. And so these small doses of stress, how are we noticing those and working with those? And that's a great place where, you know, things like mindfulness and meditation have great science. You know, mm-hmm. notice, let it go, return to something else instead of just letting those microdoses stack up. And then on these healthy practices side, how do you get small doses of things like gratitude or interest or awe or pride in my work on a regular basis, mm-hmm. as opposed to saying, you know, maybe I'll get an award 2 years from now and I'll feel good about my work for 10 minutes and that's enough to get me through the next 2 years.
I'll be miserable in my practice until you give me something shiny and that'll feel great for a minute. And I go back to misery.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and I like when you're talking about, you know, we do have these big systems. And, you know, we've had we had a fantastic conversation with Adam Crochane, who's a PA who does concierge medicine, talking about those visits and the visit lengths when you talk about the financial aspect of it all. These are all big system problems that do need a huge overhaul. And mm-hmm. there's a lot of them in this country right now. But I like how you framed it, that we seem to have this idea that we're waiting for a Herculean or Superman to come in and remove the one big thing. But it does put us in this victim mentality. And that victim mentality, I sort of associate that a little bit with a pathogenic approach, where something needs to be taken out of my way. Mm-hmm. And I am powerless against it until somebody cuts it out or poisons it. Versus this idea that we can help make things smaller and more manageable with the microdoses. Mm-hmm. So even a physician in, you know, a terrible hospital culture, you know, there are things that we can do in that, and same on the patient side as well. Mm-hmm.